Hello, and welcome to the Disability News on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. On today's program, you will hear an article from the Deseret News about a blind cyclist who completed the grueling 203-mile Logan to Jackson Hole bike race known as the Low to Jaw. I'll be reading an article from Yahoo Finance entitled, Amazon Workers with Disabilities File Suit Against Tech Giant, Alleging Systematic Discrimination, and an article from CNN entitled, I Got My Son's Disability Diagnosis 13 Years Ago, That Day Rushed Back with Tylenol Autism Headlines. You'll also hear an article from the International News in which famed actress Judi Dench opens up about her struggles with blindness, in addition to other articles of interest. But first, here's a reminder that the V-Rate, that's the Vision Rehabilitation and Technology Expo, is coming up November 14th at the Ability 360 campus. V-Rate offers individuals, families, and professionals from across Arizona free access to educational seminars on best practices in vision loss and includes emphasis on the intersectionality of other disabilities, such as hearing loss. Presentations and workshops will include topics such as using assistive technology, job readiness, advocacy, specialized learning modalities, defining independence, developing critical thinking skills, engaging in the social fabric of the community, and fostering self-determination for sustainable success. A comprehensive set of exhibitors and vendors will be on hand, including Sun Sounds of Arizona, to provide information, resources, and the opportunity to test out technology designed to be accessible to those living with vision impairments of all abilities. Registration is open. That's going to be Friday, November 14, 2025, at the Ability 360 campus. You can log in and register at vrate.org. The keynote speaker will be Jeffrey Richter, PhD. He's a freelance health and science journalist whose work focuses on disability issues. He writes for Psychology Today magazine on topics involving blindness and low vision. He's a member of the American Medical Writers Association, where he co-chairs its DEI committee. That's November 14, 2025. You can download a list of the exhibitors, the schedule of speakers, the entire program, and you can look at the exhibit hall breakout sessions at the vrate.org website. Now here's an article from the Deseret News entitled, Sometimes Not Seeing is Believing for this tandem cycling team. It was published November 10, 2025, and written by Glenn Senninger. Bruce Briner has more challenges than most, but he didn't let that stop him from completing the 203-mile Low to Jaw bike race in September. It's been a few months since cyclists completed the 43rd annual Low to Jaw bike race from Logan to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. For those who successfully finished the grueling 203-mile course, the memories live on. But for cyclists and fans alike, many are still sharing stories and talking about one of the highlights of this year's race. That's due in large part to Bruce Briner and Mike Traveler, who crossed the finish line riding in their first ever Low to Jaw relay. Briner and Traveler look like your ordinary cyclists riding together on their custom-built tandem bicycle with matching bright orange jersey. From a distance, they look like any other racers, pushing hard to stay on pace and keep the tandem bike moving forward. But upon a closer look, you'll notice a small detail that only a keen eye would notice, something you rarely see on a bike. There, strapped on the top tube of his tandem bike, was a long white cane with a bright red bottom. Briner uses this foldable cane to navigate himself when he's not riding the tandem. Briner is blind, which is something of a rarity in the cycling world. Briner suffers from a disease called retinitis pigmentosa. I grew up in the Kearns area, and as a kid, I always loved riding my bike, Briner recalls. Then, when I was in my late 20s, I started to lose my peripheral vision. The doctors said it would eventually spread to my central vision. By the age of 35, I was completely blind. Faith and family. Briner was living in the San Francisco Bay Area when he lost his sight. Married and a father of five young children, he had a successful career as a hospital administrator for Kaiser Permanente, but he decided to take early retirement due to his condition. The next challenge for Briner was finding a new way to channel his energy and adjusting to the new reality of his situation. In a world without sight, Briner was forced to change his outlook and perspective on life. He had to adjust to a new normal. Without my wife, Evelyn, my family, and my faith in the gospel of Jesus Christ, I don't know how I would have made it through those times, Briner said, trying to hold back emotions. That's what carried me through those tough days, my faith and my family. At the time, Briner decided he wasn't going to look at this situation as a disadvantage. He saw it as an opportunity. He took on this new life challenge with the same vigor and effort he had before. But would he have to give up the things he loved, like cycling? When I met with the doctors at Stanford Medical Center, they told me one of the best things I could do for my physical and mental health and overall well-being was to stay in top shape. Cycling and hiking became an outlet for Briner, something to take his mind off his situation. One day, my brother said to me, "Why don't you start riding a tandem with Evelyn?" Briner remembers. So my wife and I started riding together. What a joy that was. It really changed everything. Briner never gave up his childhood love for cycling and has been riding ever since. "I always had a desire to ride Low to Jaw if we could ever get in. It's always been a dream of mine," he said. Cycling is a family affair for Briner and Traveler, who are first cousins. Their mothers were sisters and grew up in a modest family home in Lewiston, Idaho. "The house where both our moms grew up is right on the Low to Jaw route," Traveler recalls. "It always brings back family memories for me and Bruce to talk about visiting there. We love to see that house." The race route has another family connection. Our 97-year-old aunt, Joyce Gilbert, still lives in her home in Fairview, Idaho, which is right along the Low to Jaw course. "So we had to do it," Briner explained. "We have family connections who live on the race route." So for these two cousins who went to BYU together, riding Low to Jaw was a cycling rite of passage. It was something that was always on their bucket list, almost like a family calling. "I was talking with Bruce one day, and neither of us thought we could do Low to Jaw. With the elevation and the distance, I was concerned, but Bruce really wanted to try to do it," Traveler said. "My brothers suggested we all do a relay, so I got my three brothers and their sons to join us. Bruce and I did legs 1, 4, and 5. All in all, we had 5 teams riding the 2-person relay. It was so much fun." Cycling connections. Briner lives in Iona, Idaho, and Traveler hails from Twin Falls, Idaho. They found that cycling together was a great way to reconnect and experience the thrill of racing while also setting out to accomplish a goal together. "Bruce is so inspiring to me," Traveler says. "When Bruce was a YSA bishop, he was always trying to get some kids in his ward to go on this century ride with him. But he rode on his old beachcomber-looking bike. It wasn't designed for 100-mile rides, but he did it anyway. That's the kind of person Bruce is, always trying to connect with people." Low to Jaw cyclists know that the day of the race is really a celebration of the hundreds of hours of training it takes to get there. The same was true for Team Briner Traveler. "I trained in Twin Falls with my brothers at all hours of the night and in the morning," Traveler said. Sometimes I would get up at 3 a.m. and ride in the dark to get my miles in because I knew Bruce would be at home riding on his trainer in his basement. Bruce is the most fit 70-year-old I know. Briner is also dedicated to his training regimen. He rides 6 days a week, spending long hours on his Schwinn Pro stationary bike, but he never trains on Sundays. For Low to Jaw, you pay the price before the race in your training, or you pay the price during the race if you didn't, Traveler said. Riding a tandem for cyclists with clear vision can be a serious challenge. So how does Traveler feel about being the eyes and navigator for his tandem team when he and Briner train in different cities, especially showing up at Low to Jaw when they haven't ridden together for more than a year? Honestly, I was feeling a little stressed before Low to Jaw because I'm responsible for me and Bruce, he said. But what's amazing is we are so in sync. It only took a few revolutions before we started to click. We have a sense of rhythm together. We are a team. It's that rhythm and unity, two riders pedaling in unison, both working together, that makes riding with a tandem a beautiful thing to see. Trust between riders is the bond of the tandem team. A matter of trust. I trust him completely, and he trusts me completely, Traveler said. That's the only way it works for us. We have to trust each other. It is a lot of trust, Briner said. Mike is the pilot. The person in the back is the stoker. We've done it so many times that he will tell me when to clip out, pedal harder, stand up, when a sharp turn is coming, and when we're stopping. He will communicate to me throughout the ride. But there is one part of cycling that still makes Briner a bit uneasy. Honestly, I don't like the downhill, Briner says. When it's really steep and I'm on the back of a tandem going 50 miles per hour, it just scares me. I can't see anything, so we have to be aligned as a team. But I understand that we lose so much of our momentum on the climbs, so we have to make up for it somewhere. So far, this teamwork approach has helped the dynamic duo to avoid serious accidents. Bruce is such a smart rider, Traveler said. He will study the course for months leading up to the race, and he will tell me what we have coming up on the road ahead of us. It's like he sees the course in his mind, where the climbs and turns are and what's coming ahead. I don't know how he does it. How does a sightless rider prepare for a course as varied as Low to Jaw, with its summit climbs, flat stretches, and descents? My wife Evelyn is amazing, Briner said. She spends the time to go over the course map with me. We have driven the Low to Jaw course many times in the car, and I have had that in my mind, and she tells me where the turns are and what she sees and where we go. Then she reads some of the descriptions of the grades and the elevation. She's my eyes in preparing for the course. Teamwork. It's that teamwork that caused other cyclists along the Low to Jaw course to take notice of the Briner Traveler team. People recognize Bruce on the ride, Traveler said. He has that white stick strapped to the bike, and all sorts of people were talking to us and clapping for us during the race. I will never forget the last 10 miles, which are the hardest for me, that there was a young boy running along the side of the road yelling to us, "Go, tandem! It takes teamwork to make the dream work." That really lifted my spirits. For Briner, it's those sounds and voices of encouragement that he hears along the race course that motivate him to keep pedaling. At that time, I could tell the voice was that of a young man who had to be 13 or 14 years old. His voice was so excited, and he was really cheering us on. I was thinking to myself, this young man stood there on the side of the road just to cheer on cyclists. I've got to finish, Briner said. As the duo started to near the finish line, Briner could hear the race announcer in the distance. As we got closer, Mike would say, 5K to go, then 3K to go. I knew we were going to make it. As we got closer, I could hear the announcer's voice as the riders crossed the finish line. Then I could hear the fans cheering get louder and louder as we got closer to the finish. I've never been in a race before with fans. That cheering really lifted my spirits and gave me the power to push on. Cycling community. The cycling community is a close one. And for Traveler, who was starting to feel the effects of a long day of racing, it gave him a much-needed lift. I was fully spent. I wasn't sure if I was going to make it all the way, but I kept thinking I didn't want to let Bruce down, Traveler said. So luckily for us, we had a good friend from Twin Falls, Russ Mays, who helped us the entire day, and he really pulled us to the finish line. Russ helped with our nutrition and hydration. People don't realize that with a blind person on a tandem, you don't just reach for your water bottle anytime you want. You have to be careful and pick your spots. Because of that, I often get dehydrated because I don't drink enough. With only a few kilometers to go, the entire relay team pulled together, and as a team, they all made a push for the line. Sometimes it's kind of emotional coming into the finish line, Traveler said. Both of our wives and families are there to meet us, but getting there safe is a huge sense of relief. Briner recalls, when we got to the finish line, one cyclist that we had passed along the course came up to us and said, I want you to know what an inspiration you both were to me today. Every time you passed me, I felt I have the will to finish. I could do it. This motivation is what fuels Briner and Traveler. We all have obstacles in life, but how we choose to take them on is up to us, Traveler said. How easy would it be to sit on the couch and not ride a bike? But Bruce doesn't. He hikes, rides bikes, he's done the Hiawatha Trail. He is amazing. When his kids asked him what he wanted for his 70th birthday, he said all he wanted to do was ride his bike 70 miles. For Briner, his low to jaw experience was another pedal stroke, another revolution of his wheels in a long and winding journey of achieving the impossible in his life. Briner not only finds joy in cycling, but also in his church calling as the patriarch for the Iona, Idaho South stake of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The physical and the spiritual. I believe there's a real connection between your physical and spiritual health, he said. I value my physical health, and it helps me spiritually in so many ways. I'm an early riser, so I'm up at 5 a.m. each day for my daily worship and communion each and every morning. The Spirit speaks to me in the quiet hours of the morning. I cherish those times. I have my quiet time to think about the names of those people that have requested a patriarchal blessing. They are always on my mind. One might wonder how a patriarch who can't see fulfills his church calling. I have to be spiritually tuned in because I don't have the eyesight I used to have, Briner said. When people come to me for a patriarchal blessing, I see them as a person. I don't see their physical appearance. I see them as a child of heavenly parentage. I see them as a child of God, a loving Father in heaven who knows who they are and knows who they will become. He can see their potential. I feel light from them. I can't see anything with my eyes, but I can feel their light. I'm truly blessed by my calling and for that experience. With their first low to jaw now behind them, both Briner and Traveler begin to reminisce a bit. I have an amazing wife, and having the gospel in my life has helped me during the most difficult times. On those hard days, I focus on my abilities, on what I can do, not what I can't do. I feel grateful that I have people in my life that love and support me and help me achieve my goals and dreams, Briner said. So next year, if you are one of the lucky ones to ride low to jaw, take a moment to take in all the beauty the race has to offer, the fall colors and the towering peaks of the Grand Tetons at the finish. But be sure to keep an eye out to say hello to Bruce and Mike. You can't miss a tandem team with two road warriors wearing orange cycling jerseys with the trademark white cane strapped to the back. This next piece comes from UC Berkeley Law. It's entitled, Paving the Accessible Way. Disability rights titan Arlene Mayerson, 77, on her distinguished career. By Gwyneth K. Shaw. Published November 10, 2025. When Arlene Mayerson, class of 77, arrived at Berkeley Law, the course she teaches today, Disability Rights, didn't exist. In fact, neither did the field. But the first steps toward her distinguished career as a key player in the development and passage of the landmark Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, in 1990, then over decades more of path-breaking advocacy, happened at the law school. "I went to law school to be a civil rights lawyer," Mayerson says. Berkeley Law, with its ties to the broader free speech movement, civil rights, and feminism, was a beacon from across the country. "As it turned out, law school just clicked with my brain," Mayerson said. "I made sure to take every single course Herma Hill Kay taught," she adds, noting that the legendary professor and Berkeley Law's first woman dean was one of just three women on the faculty during her student days. Mayerson snagged an externship with U.S. District Judge W. Arthur Garrity, the judge overseeing the long and contentious fight over school desegregation and busing in Boston, and was detailed to work on another constitutional case concerning the treatment of inmates in the Charles Street Jail. A historic movement. The movement that would animate her professional life was ramping up around the same time, concentrating at first around the failure to issue regulations to enforce Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, the first significant federal disability civil rights legislation in American history. San Francisco was one of the demonstration sites, and the news articles about the sit-in protests really captured my imagination, Mayerson said. After graduating Order of the Coif, she pursued a Master of Laws, LLM, at the Institute for Public Representation at Georgetown University Law Center, working with other public interest organizations on a wide range of cases. Back in the Bay Area, Mayerson started looking for civil rights jobs, and an opening at the nascent Disability Law Resource Center popped up. The brand new center was under the umbrella of the Center for Independent Living, CIL, in Berkeley, the first of its kind in the nation. "Like all of CIL, there was disabled leadership," she says. "My first interview wasn't even with lawyers, it was with activists. And even though I had good credentials from Berkeley and Georgetown, what really impressed them was that I got the rubric of disability exclusion and segregation being a civil rights issue, because it really wasn't known that way at all. It was known as a social welfare issue." The director of DLRC said he wanted a blank slate, and I tell my Berkeley law students today that I was that blank slate, and I was written in the movement's image. I was working hand in hand with the leadership of the disability rights movement, learning from them and following the lead of the movement. Driving force. In 1978, the founders of the DLRC hit on the idea of creating a national disability civil rights organization modeled on the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and others like it. The Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, DREDF, was born. DREDF began with a meeting of leading civil rights attorneys, policymakers, and activists with the goal of introducing these leaders to disability as a civil rights issue. By the end of the gathering, it was clear that the organization needed a Washington, D.C. office to have a national impact. Mayerson was one half of the team chosen to run it, arriving shortly after Ronald Reagan's inauguration, with cutbacks to the then-new Section 504 regulations looming. After beating back those attempts and working on several pieces of legislation to overturn negative Supreme Court decisions in the 1980s, DREDF and Mayerson were in a good position to lead the legislative efforts to pass the ADA in 1990. That decade of the 80s was about building up the trust of people who were going to be the movers and shakers on Capitol Hill to get the ADA done, she says. "I tell my students that it is critical to gain credibility with the members of their staff. They have to know they can rely on you to know the issues, that you can work hard and fast, and that they can trust you to get it right. Mayerson excelled in that role. In his book, Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights, Leonard J. Davis calls Mayerson the brains behind the Americans with Disabilities Act. Her efforts, alongside the many others who brokered the landmark law, are enshrined in an episode of the PBS show American Experience, Change Not Charity, the Americans with Disabilities Act. Pushing ahead. After the ADA became law, the next challenge was enforcing it. Mayerson has been at the forefront there as well, reeling off a string of victories, forcing the California Department of Education to provide care for diabetic students, mandating that internet-only companies like Netflix provide closed captions for their streaming shows, and shaping a settlement with Harvard and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology over web accessibility that now extends to all U.S. colleges and universities. My role has always been to push the envelope and to see where the ADA could be used in ways that weren't obvious or explicit, she says. Mayerson got the idea for the initial suit against Netflix from watching at home on her couch. When Netflix first came out and there was streaming at home, I was very excited. I'm hard of hearing and I was used to using captions on TV. And I opened the Netflix app and when the video started streaming, I thought, wait a minute, there's no captions, she says. I was told by every single person I would ask, you can't bring that case. Title III of the ADA is about places of public accommodations, so that's what Mayerson homed in on. I argued that the Netflix streaming site is a place of public accommodations, that streaming is a service of public accommodation, and that, therefore, the streaming site had to be accessible to deaf and hard of hearing customers, she says. The judge agreed, and the historic settlement of National Association of the Deaf versus Netflix had a domino effect. All the big streamers quickly signed on to their own settlements. The power of it is so amazing, Mayerson says. As a retired person, the thing I miss the most is having that kind of impact on the world. Training the next generation. But Mayerson isn't out of the arena yet. She still teaches disability rights at Berkeley Law, where she's been a lecturer since 1988. These days, she teams up with DREDF Public Policy Director Sylvia Yee and Elizabeth Zerker, senior attorney at the National Health Law Project. I consider it my responsibility. It's a way of giving back, she says. I feel like I learned legislative lawyering on the job, and it's really important for students to know this whole other avenue of the law that can have huge impacts. I also like to bring in some of the behind-the-scenes strategy in litigation. Looking back, Mayerson says she can't imagine a more stimulating and impactful career. Along the way, she's picked up a stream of accolades, including the Spirit of Independence Leading Advocate Award from the Center for Independent Living in 1993, the American Diabetes Association Public Policy Award in 1997, the Henry Viscardi Achievement Award, and in 2014, the Starkloff Disability Institute's Open Door Award in 2015, and the American Bar Association Paul G. Hearn Award for Disability Rights in 2016. In 2018, she was recognized as a National Women's History Project honoree. She hopes today's students get the same opportunities amid cuts at the U.S. Department of Education and other efforts to turn back the clock on civil rights. I was just so lucky, at the right place, at the right time, she says, and I'm very grateful for that. I wondered on the first day of class this year how students feel about studying civil rights in the face of recent setbacks. But I think the students still feel the energy that they want to use their lawyering skills to advance the greater good. And today's students know that race, Gender, disability, and ethnicity are all intertwined in the wider civil rights movement. They understand the intersectionality. I want to thank them for having this interest because it's so personal to me and so historically relevant. Next up is an article from Yahoo Finance entitled, Amazon Workers with Disabilities File Suit Against Tech Giant Alleging Systematic Discrimination. This was written by Laura Bratton, and it was published on November 8, 2025. But before we start that article, I need to remind you that this is the Disability News on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now to the article. A group of Amazon, AMZN, employees has filed a lawsuit against the tech giant, claiming the company systematically discriminated against disabled workers, in part due to its alleged use of artificial intelligence. 9 Amazon employees across multiple divisions and states filed a complaint proposing a class action in a federal district court in Seattle on October 20th. Their suit claims Amazon unlawfully denies nearly all medical requests to work remotely as the tech giant pursues its controversial return-to-office policy and allegedly uses AI to handle accommodations requests. The suit said the company terminates employees or forces them to take unpaid leave rather than granting their requests for medical accommodations. A judge must certify the lawsuit as a class action for it to move forward. The company filed a response opposing the complaint this past Tuesday, arguing the employee's case is fundamentally flawed. Amazon spokesperson Brad Glasser told Yahoo Finance in an email, "Most of the allegations in this case are simply untrue and intentionally misleading, and we plan to demonstrate that through the legal process." The plaintiffs are represented by New York-based law firm Harmon Green PC, which represents about 24 disabled Amazon employees overall. "We feel very confident about our claims," said attorney Walker Harmon Jr. The legal action is one of the latest in a series of employee discrimination lawsuits against Amazon. In late October, New Jersey's Attorney General filed a complaint accusing the company of discriminating against disabled and pregnant warehouse workers. In 2022, the New York State Division of Human Rights filed a similar lawsuit, alleging that Amazon's policies force disabled and pregnant warehouse workers to take unpaid leave rather than accommodate them. Many other cases have been filed by workers against the tech giant in the last decade, alleging disability, race, and gender discrimination. Such cases have yielded mixed outcomes, some resulting in wins by workers and settlements, others in victories for Amazon. Amazon is one of the largest U.S. employers with more than 1.5 million employees. Last week, it announced thousands of layoffs as it aggressively invests in AI. The employees participating in the latest suit, which will be ruled on as a class action by Judge John Chun in the Western District of Washington, should it go forward, ranged from warehouse workers to software engineers. Nearly all of the workers allege Amazon failed to grant medical accommodations necessary to their health and safety. The complaint says that Amazon's requirement that employees use its A to Z app when requesting accommodations created technical issues and resulted in significant delays. Ashley Cook, an Amazon cloud engineer and a military veteran from Texas with uterine fibroids, alleges in the complaint that Amazon unlawfully placed her on unpaid leave against her will after ignoring her requests in its A to Z app to work remotely as a means of managing her condition. Another plaintiff, Amy Rooker, an investment manager for Amazon's cloud division, claims she suffered serious injuries from a car accident, which caused chronic pain that limited her ability to commute to work safely. Rooker's remote work accommodation request was denied. The company refused her request to appeal the denial, and she was terminated from her position, according to the complaint. Meanwhile, warehouse worker David Ottenweller alleges he was terminated after he was hospitalized as a result of his mental health disability. Another warehouse worker, Michelle Grissom, said she was put on unpaid leave and ultimately terminated after requesting an accommodation for her seizure symptoms. The lawsuit alleges that the problems faced by plaintiffs are likely more widespread, potentially representative of tens of thousands of current and former employees of Amazon. According to an internal document provided to Yahoo Finance by a group of Amazon workers called Disabled Employees United, which was verified by Amazon, the company receives a slew of accommodations requests, roughly 725 daily as of 2024. On an annual basis, the lawsuit estimates Amazon's accommodation requests could tally as high as 255,000 per year. Amazon declined to disclose how many requests it receives or how many are granted. More discrimination lawsuits from disabled employees could be coming. Jasno Dolmer, a spokesperson for Disabled Employees United, which includes 662 Amazon disabled corporate employees who are working to form a union, said nearly all of the group's members are lawyering up to fight the company's handling of accommodation requests. So far, at least 140 members of Disabled Employees United have been granted the right to sue the company by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, a key procedural step that allows them to take their case to court, according to a poll conducted by the group. The EEOC did not respond to a request to confirm that figure. Amazon told Yahoo Finance it is testing the use of AI for administrative tasks related to accommodations requests, but not for making decisions on cases. The tech giant has increasingly looked to use AI internally as it invests hundreds of billions of dollars in infrastructure to power its AI products. CEO Andy Jassy said in June that the company would reduce its workforce as it implements AI, and the company recently announced it would cut 14,000 jobs. Using automation to handle accommodation requests for disabled workers is controversial. Former EEOC Chair Charlotte Burroughs told Yahoo Finance, "More and more employees are in a situation where they are looking to vindicate their rights under the law and cannot get relief because they're in an automated process that doesn't allow them to appeal to a person. When you have a disability claim, you have a right to an interactive process. The employers have to engage. In other words, the Americans with Disabilities Act requires employers to engage in good faith back and forth discussions, an interactive process with an employee who has requested a reasonable accommodation for a disability. The October lawsuit claims Amazon prevents employees from notifying others about their rights under the law, saying that Amazon deleted Slack messages from one of its plaintiffs who shared resources for disabled employees if they felt their rights had been violated. Amazon has multiple Slack channels for employees with disabilities that include thousands of members, according to a review of Slack channels seen by Yahoo Finance. Dolmer said the issue is having a chilling effect and that some members of his group have received warnings of disciplinary action for posting such messages in Slack. Amazon said the messages violate its solicitation policy. Glasser, Amazon's spokesperson, told Yahoo Finance, "We're committed to supporting our employees by providing accommodations that meet their individual needs and the needs of the business." Now here's a piece from The News entitled, "Oscar winner Judi Dench opens up about daily struggles with blindness." The Oscar-winning star won Best Supporting Actress for Shakespeare in Love. This was published November 7, 2025. Dame Judi Dench shares heartbreaking health update as she reveals she has lost her sight. The legendary actress, 90, has opened up about the daily challenges she faces with her health, revealing she has now lost her vision completely. The Oscar-winning star, who won Best Supporting Actress for Shakespeare in Love, spoke publicly about her age-related macular degeneration, AMD, in 2012. Earlier this year, she admitted she can't leave home alone due to the progressive condition. Speaking to crowds at Theatre Royal in Bury Street, St. Edmunds, where she serves as a patron, Dame Judi said, "When I go to the theatre, I can't see. Hopeless." Despite her blindness, she's been keeping up with the latest on Celebrity Traders and hearing updates about her friend Celia Imrie through word of mouth. The actress also revealed that reading scripts has become impossible, highlighting the impact of her worsening eyesight on her work. On Trini Woodall's Fearless podcast, Dame Judi explained that she always has someone accompany her when leaving the house. "Somebody will always be with me when she leaves the house." She continued, "I have to have someone now because I can't see." The Golden Eye actress, known for her iconic role as M on 9 James Bond films, admitted she was no good at that at all when attending events alone in the past. And now an article from CNN entitled, "I got my son's disability diagnosis 13 years ago. That day rushed back with Tylenol autism headlines." It's a personal essay by Jacqueline Greenberg, published November 9, 2025. Hearing President Donald Trump link Tylenol use during pregnancy to the development of autism in children, without evidence, takes me back many years to when my son was born. "My son has multiple disabilities because I caught a virus when I was pregnant. I've struggled with guilt for something I could not control since the day I received his disability diagnosis 13 years ago. I spent years trying to rewind time in my mind to figure out when I got sick, but I didn't get much relief from that exercise. Mothers feel responsible for so many things that happen to their children, even things they can't control, and parents of children with disabilities can feel that sense of responsibility even more. I still struggle with intense feelings at times, so I reached out to experts to better understand how to process these emotions. Here's how they recommend handling those intense feelings. What happens when you get a diagnosis? Medical providers tell pregnant mothers to follow certain guidelines to keep their babies safe. When their child is born sick or receives a medical diagnosis, moms may look back on the time when they were pregnant to understand why. That self-reflection can happen because of an internal quest for understanding, because something happened, like the virus I caught, or because someone blames acetaminophen, sold under the brand name Tylenol, for autism. Parents of kids with disabilities are looking for answers, said Kara Kushner, founder and clinical worker at A Work of Heart Counseling in Bergen County, New Jersey. She also has a sibling who has profound disabilities. "They want to understand their kid and they want to understand how to help them," Kushner told me. "If they're thinking about having more children, they want to prevent further hardship for their family. And there's a real validity to that experience. Life is harder for parents of kids with disabilities." As for comment, Kenvu Brands, the maker of Tylenol, referred to the company's public statement, which read in part, "We believe independent, sound science clearly shows that taking acetaminophen does not cause autism. We strongly disagree with allegations that it does and are deeply concerned about the health risks and confusion this poses for expecting mothers and parents." Looking for a reason. This isn't the first time mothers have been blamed for autism, explained Kushner. In the 1950s, the refrigerator theory implied that mothers of kids with autism were emotionally cold and distant. It's an assumption that most professionals eventually discredited. Regardless of the reason, mothers of kids with disabilities can feel like they live in a world that other people can't understand. If it feels like it has anything to do with us, it can further compound the shame or the disconnection we might experience from the world, society, and other communities, because our children have more significant needs than other kids, Kushner said. I know the feeling of disconnect from my own experience. No matter how many times I replayed my pregnancy in my head, I couldn't turn back time and avoid the virus that caused my son's disabilities. But parents of kids with disabilities have to eventually accept that we cannot change the past. When those feelings resurface, I try to follow Kushner's advice to take a minute to pause and process my feelings, since an emotional response could cloud my judgment. What I learned I could do is focus on the present and then do my best to make plans. For example, I learn about programs that will support my whole family and think about where my son will thrive as an adult. As hard as it can be to corral my thoughts, refocusing my energy helps everyone in my family. Refocusing my energy on reality. We only have so much energy to take care of our families, work, and be socially engaged ourselves, explained Dr. Sharon Arts, a clinical psychologist in Metuchen, New Jersey, who works with parents of kids with disabilities. Deciding how to use our energy is key. Do we want to spend all of our time just regretting and feeling bad, or do we consciously choose to invest ourselves in the present, connect and enjoy our children, help to plan the future, and really engage? Arts said. It's a decision about what is the best use of my energy. I can't do everything, so what should I use it for? Arts works with her clients to sort out which thoughts are helpful and which aren't. When something's good for them, it tends to be good for their families too, she said. At the end of the day, I have found that being a mom who feels good can be there for everyone in the family. When the mom's needs are met, it's much easier to do everything else. Finding connections in the community. From the day my son was born, my experience was different from my two other children. Starting with understanding his diagnosis, to working with doctors and physical and occupational therapists, to learning how to support him, I was busy figuring out how to care for my son and readjusting my own expectations of what motherhood would be like. This different process made it hard to connect with friends and family and keep them updated. When you have a child that is different from the norm and has more needs, you already feel like you're doing it wrong because you're doing it differently, Kushner said. People don't know what to make of you or how to interact with you. That divide can be extremely isolating. For example, some days I spend the morning talking to mothers at my son's school about doctor appointments and therapies, and then spend the afternoon talking to mothers at my daughter's school about town sports and Girl Scouts. One of the challenges I find is that women struggle to find out how to stay related to their communities, stay engaged, and to have friends when they have one foot in each world, Arts said. Creating connections with other parents in the disability community can help bridge that divide. Even if they're talking about different disabilities between the children, they still understand the experience of being a parent in a much more challenging circumstance, she added. Focusing on the support. Understanding the reasons why and how disability happens is important. That can lead to future children not having those disabilities, as is the case with the virus that caused my son's disability. With a diagnosis such as autism, people want to know if it's more prevalent now or if we just have better diagnostic tools these days, explained Kushner. But continuing the conversation about supporting families who have a child with a disability is just as important, she noted. In 2024, the U.S. Surgeon General issued an advisory to mothers and caregivers that they should focus on mental health because they're under increased stress. But how to do that without institutional support? The talk is all about cause and cure and fix and treat, and there aren't a lot of conversations about support, resources, programs, and financial backing, Kushner said. Those are things that can really make a difference in the lives of all parents of kids with disabilities. 13 years after my son was born, I still struggle with feelings of disconnect from the rest of the world. But most of my energy is spent getting our family through the day and fighting for all of my kids to have equal access to life's experiences. My other two children recognized inaccessibility and lack of inclusion from an early age, and we work as a family to make sure we get out in the world and have fun together. Coping with feelings of guilt. Before emotionally reacting to something that feels like an accusation or blame, take a minute to breathe. Decide how you want to use your energy. You can't change the past, and you can only control the decisions you make today and in the future. Meet other parents and guardians through your child's school or therapy sessions, or online in communities for parents of kids with disabilities who can relate and be supportive. Find and use resources that support families of kids with disabilities, such as local nonprofit organizations. Jacqueline Greenberg has written for the New York Times, Wired, Good Housekeeping, and Parents. She's working on a book for parents of kids with disabilities. This next piece comes from the Disability Scoop. It's entitled, White House Ordered to Step Up Accessibility, by Sean Heasley, published November 11, 2025. A federal judge is directing the White House to reinstate sign language interpreters at many press briefings months after they were abruptly removed. The White House must provide a qualified American Sign Language interpreter at all publicly announced press briefings conducted by President Donald Trump or White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt under a preliminary injunction issued earlier this month by U.S. District Judge Amir H. Ali. The decision comes in a lawsuit filed earlier this year by the National Association of the Deaf and two deaf individuals after the White House stopped including interpreters at briefings in January. They argued that ASL is a unique language with its own grammar and structure, and closed captioning in English is insufficient for many ASL speakers. Failing to provide ASL interpreters violates Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, the lawsuit said. White House briefings engage the American people on important issues affecting their daily lives. In recent months, war, the economy, and health care, and in recent years, a global pandemic, Ali's opinion states. The exclusion of deaf Americans from that programming, in addition to likely violating the Rehabilitation Act, is clear and present harm that the court cannot meaningfully remedy after the fact. The National Association of the Deaf had also sought to have ASL interpreters at all press briefings and events conducted by the Vice President, First Lady, and Second Lady, but the judge's order, which is meant to provide preliminary relief while the case proceeds, is more limited. Bobby Beth Scoggins, interim chief executive officer at the National Association of the Deaf, welcomed the judge's order. The court's ruling affirms what we have long known. Equal access to information from the White House is not optional. We deserve the same timely, direct access to White House briefings as everyone else, Scoggins said. This is not the first time that the National Association of the Deaf has sued the White House over the availability of ASL interpreters. In 2020, a federal district court ordered the White House to provide interpreters for all coronavirus-related briefings. After that, a policy was put in place to provide ASL interpreters for press briefings conducted by the President, Vice President, First Lady, Second Gentleman, or the White House Press Secretary, the group said. The Trump administration indicated in documents filed with the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia that it plans to appeal the preliminary injunction. However, the White House will proceed with providing ASL interpreters for publicly announced press briefings, noting that it continues to have a contract with an ASL interpreter service that extends into 2028. And that's the disability news for this time. This is your volunteer reader, John Curry. Thank you very much for tuning in, and please join us again next time.